Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week at the station of KHOI Community Radio to talk about food farming. We talk about advice, recipes, and opinions. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes, the Donald in the Kitchen show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Today with us, around our kitchen table, we have someone that tells stories. We have a filmmaker with us named Graham Merriweather. Thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Great.
So, Graham, Lana and I saw your new movie last night. Now, this is – Graham makes agrarian movies. Is that how you would characterize it?
Sure.
Okay. Even though he lives in New York City. What was your first film was called?
American Meat.
And what did you do in that film?
That film was a in-depth look at America's chicken, cattle, and hog production.
And the farmers who do it, basically.
Yeah. I had been reading a book called The Omnivore's Dilemma, and I went and spent a year filming with Joel Salatin on Polyface Farms in Virginia. And then Joel basically... There was a moment in the film where he started talking about the terrible conditions in basically like an egg laying operation. And so I sent an email to PETA and I said, could you send us some stock footage? And they sent along a tape.
That's People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
That's right.
PETA.
That's right.
And they can be rather radical. Although they did... Many years ago, they got all the Hollywood starlets to stop wearing animal furs.
That's right. That's right. And so PETA sent a tape, and they basically – it's the tape you would watch if you were on YouTube and typed in, like, meet your meat. And I started editing that into the film, and it didn't feel right because I had never been to those farms. I'd never talked to those farmers. And so I made a vow, which was I wasn't going to use a single frame of hidden camera footage, and I spent the next 2 years...
Oh, bravo for you, yeah.
...going around the country and filming with conventional chicken farmers and hog farmers and cattle raisers, and I realized that, you know, they're family farmers. They're just walking the path that they walk in their lives, and they were incredibly kind and wonderful people, and they were often making decisions to keep their family farm going that... were very conflicted, and they only signed contracts with big integrators because they felt like they had no other options. And so the film really became a respectful dialogue about the different types of meat production in America and what's the best step forward for us in the years ahead.
Well, and I now, having seen your second film as well.
And the name of it is?
Oh, yes. It's what's it called?
Farmers for America.
Farmers for America. So the second film is, Graham, is really shedding light on the beginning farmer issues. But I want to say that what I feel the best about between the two of them is your respectfulness to all ways that farmers do engage in their businesses. And you're right, especially living here in Iowa, we know that very, very well. We have all of the ag issues here, and we have a big, as you saw last night, there are a number of beginning farmers, but it is an issue. So tell us about the second film.
Well, we did 220 screenings that I personally went to of American Meat, and we had local food together beforehand. We watched the film, and then we had panel discussions afterwards, and... At all of those,
so same format as last night. Then.
Same format as last night, and at those discussions, we kept hearing people talk about the young farmer issue. And in fact, I met a lot of the people who were in Farmers for America while I was doing screenings of American Meat. So Garrett Grider, who's a young man who's trying to start a farm in Missouri, I met him at a screening of American Meat in Truman State University, and he just told me, like, I'm trying to buy land, but I can't find it. Mm-hmm. And so this film.
And
we
Graham
sowed the
is,
seeds for Farmers for America while we were sort of harvesting the first film, and I'm doing the same thing now. So as I'm talking to people, I'm trying to get a sense of like what are the most interesting
what are their issues, right?
Issues.
Plus,
that,
Graham
you know,
is the peer of a lot of beginning farmer kinds of. So I think that probably helped you as a filmmaker to because you're kind of reinventing yourself in your business all the time.
Yeah, it's very similar. I mean, I'm very frequently sleeping on their couches or in their spare bedroom, and I'm dealing with a lot of the same challenges that young farmers face because I'm self-distributing my film, and you know, I've made a very conscious decision not to apply to any film festivals, and to bring the film and premiere the film in rural areas where I film because I feel like those audiences and those communities are where the film is most relevant. So actually, you know, this type of a film, which would not get into Sundance, but even let's say it did, like that would be totally irrelevant to.
They wouldn't understand it.
Yeah, they would be like, "What is this? Yeah, what is this you're talking about?" So, yeah, so we're bringing it directly to the. It's very similar direct marketing with the farmers. Mm-hmm, like we're mm-hmm. bringing the film directly to the customers.
I think it's a very clever, very important political and ethical strategy. Last night the films were. Let's see, it was at the ISU Alumni Building, but it was sponsored by Practical Farmers of Iowa, the ISU Beginning Farmers. What's that called?
Network.
Network, and. A couple of other ISU entities. Do you remember who they were?
I do not.
Okay. Anyway, it was a lot of sort of what we would call conventional ag people, and they invited a lot of their older students. The room was about half young men who were going to be farmers.
Yeah, you could tell by the hats. You could just look around.
I mean, you really could. And there was this seriousness about them. Something, you know, that we can all recognize is I'm going to be a farmer like my dad.
That's true.
And the issues in the film are very appropriate for them because it's, like the one, there was a panel afterwards. There was the one young man who farms with his dad or is going to farm with his dad in Nevada. Now, his dad has 5,000 acres. Of course, he didn't say how many siblings he has, but this is always the problem of how do you support another family and generation on the farm? And your film speaks to this a lot.
Well, I mean, one thing that I keep hearing again and again as I'm going around and doing screenings of this film is people telling me about just how hard it is to get land. So I had a commodity hog farmer the other day telling me that he's unable to pass the farm along to his son because he would have to buy more land or get more hogs and he doesn't have the capital to do that. So what his son is doing and him and his son and his daughter-in-law, they're starting a vegetable farm and starting to sell their produce at the local farmers market, I believe here in Ames or might have been Des Moines. But you can see that innovation and finding a new market is going to be the way that young people can get in because if we keep consolidating, you're not going to have a young person take over a $10 million farming operation because that would be dumb on a lot of levels.
Well, not only that, how many 5,000 acre farms are we going to have here? You know, we're not talking about the 40 acres and a mule anymore. We only have so many 5,000 acre tracts available. So that limits the number of farmers we can have as well. Plus, with the prices of corn and beans right now, if I were a family farmer and my children were, you know, diversity and diversifying with this generation might be a very good just in terms of an investment strategy, what other things? And I know from Practical Farmers of Iowa, a number of farmers are doing things like that. Well, the wife is growing flowers in a hoop house, and the you know, and that doesn't take thousands of acres or even hundreds of acres. It's you know, it's a value added proposition. And in the crowd last night, because. Well, Graham, tell us what kind of farmers are in the film first.
It's a pretty wide range. We have a lot of large-scale grain farmers, commodity farmers, hog farmers. We have vegetable farmers. There's large-scale organic. There's small-scale organic. There's local. Basically, it runs the gamut, and we filmed in every region of the United States as well. So it's a wide breadth where we meet about 20 farmers in a 5-minute, 2 to 5 minute sort of window. So it's a lot. You get to see a lot and a lot of different stories. The flip side is we don't go super deep with a lot of those. So it's kind of like you get sort of have a really wide.
But you get some meaningful dialogue from each farmer. And I have to say, the footage of the corn was the 12-row corn harvester.
The combine.
Nice footage.
Oh, thank
you. That was really beautiful. I mean, we see them in the fields all the time. But you know what? I've never been up sitting in one and looking at all, from a distance. You see that corn just spilling out into the trucks, but your footage was really quite beautiful. In fact, all of your footage is beautiful. Makes farming seem so romantic.
Well, I want to say I enjoyed the film a lot because I love watching other
people. Lana's a farmer.
I love watching other people farm and to see such a huge variety. And some of the visits with the farmer, I could say, I didn't know that. Look how they're doing that. Or in another instance, I could say, I've got one of those. And it really makes you proud to be a farmer. It makes you aware of what it takes. And farming is so much more, although people talk about farming as a business and yes, we're talking about meeting the debts, and we're meeting payments, and we're buying land. All the people talk about also, this is a family thing. This is a way I live. I'm here because I like being outside. I don't want to be sitting behind a desk anymore. It's amazing. You really did travel from Maine all the way, zigging, zagging, all the way to California. You did a fine job. And here's my favorite part of the whole show. I really am glad to know that there are American flags made out of hemp. Oh, what a good... It's just the images and the...
Handmade, spun, sewn.
Yes,
by hand.
That kind of sums it up. I like that a lot.
Yeah, that's a really inspiring story. We have Mike Lewis, who is the first American farmer to grow hemp since it was...
What, is it Kentucky, right?
Yeah. He's based in Kentucky, Richmond, Kentucky, and he's a military veteran who actually his service was in military funerals. So he has a very unique relationship with the American flag where, basically the context of it is that he sees it as a symbol of sacrifice. And so one of the first things he wanted to grow as a hemp farmer was hemp to make American flags. And the flags are beautiful. And it was really inspiring to see that sort of process happen.
And in your film, you have quite a few farmer vets in the film. Want to talk about the Farmer Veteran Coalition?
Yeah, it's something that a lot of people are pretty excited about when they hear about it for the first time because you have – it's something that may not seem initially like two things that go together. But when you think about it, like most military veterans are from rural America, so they have that kind of work ethic and that kind of experience. And then also we listen briefly to someone named Matthew Amott, and he talks about how, in military you're killing people and breaking things, and then in agriculture you're kind of providing, growing the food that sustains life. So it can be a very healing activity for the military veterans coming back.
Yeah, I think they've gotten this program's been going on for at least 5 years or something, and there's some of it going on in Iowa. And I think they've gotten some really good statistics on how much farming and those kinds of nature outdoors activities have helped with PTSD. Whole nother ball game there.
So, yeah.
There's been some decent funding for returning vets to farm. Not enough, but
yeah, absolutely. They've gotten a lot of stuff in the farm bill over the years, a lot of money, and I think that's a wonderful thing because a lot of times they're coming back and they sort of are still looking for a way to serve the country. And so I feel like there's a real sense of service in agriculture. And so it really mm-hmm. gives these people an opportunity to do something that continues to give back to the country in a totally different way and in a healing way.
This is KHOY 89.1 FM. This is the Donalana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. In the kitchen with Graham Merriweather, a fine filmmaker, and he produced a film called Farmers for America. Donna and I just recently saw that program.
One of the questions at last night's talk session afterwards. Now, one thing, those weren't FFA kids last night, were they?
I bet most of those kids were probably in FFA at some point, but they're not currently in FFA.
Graham is doing this really, I think it's a really wonderful way of distributing the film, is going around and showing it. That is Future Farmers of America. It's an old organization. I brought in a patch that was my father's from FFA in the, you know, probably in the 1930s or something like this. And it used to be FHA, the Future Homemakers of America, but I don't think we do that anymore. But so one of the things that Graham is doing is showing this film about different kinds of beginning farmers and different avenues for beginning farmers to high school students.
Yeah, and FFA is just an incredible organization.
It really is, still.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the largest youth organization in America, and if that's not right, it's definitely the largest youth agricultural education institution in America. There's, I believe it's 600,000 members, and there are chapters in all of the states. There's about 7,500 chapters, and basically it's a really wonderful way for kids to actually do hands-on things. So they have something called their Supervised Agricultural Experience, their SAE project.
And that's part of their high school.
That's part of it. And they get credit for that. And there have been kids that actually start viable farm businesses from that. You have a lot of really cool hands-on making food, starting businesses. And it's a really wonderful organization that – to be honest, a lot of America's next farmers are in FFA right now. And so if our goal for this film is to help support and inspire young people who are interested in agriculture, there's really no better organization than FFA for us to be doing these screenings, which is why we chose to premiere the film at the National FFA Convention in Indianapolis.
Oh.
And so we premiered the film there. And then this is our first – came to Iowa to do our first sort of sustained screenings for FFA chapters. And, yeah, it's very, very inspiring and humbling and wonderful to be able to have those types of conversations and screenings with FFA chapters.
Well, tell us a little bit about your more interesting reactions that you've gotten from high school kids when they see this film.
They're really interested in innovation. That just keeps coming up again and again. Like, for instance,
means around here, it means not necessarily growing corn and soy.
Yeah, like this morning, because as I said earlier with American Meat, I was filming Farmers for America while we were distributing American Meat, and I brought my camera this time. And this morning, I was just filming with Southeast Polk FFA in Pleasantville near Des Moines, and basically, there was a kid there who's running this incredibly complex, beautiful aquaponics system that has 800 gallons worth of water and probably, I think it's 90 fish. And he's actually growing – it's not just him, but the students there are growing a lot of lettuce that they harvest every week. Today he harvested 7 pounds of lettuce from his – bed, and that went directly to the cafeteria. The cafeteria pays the FFA chapter.
Oh, wow.
And so you've got a situation where for one day of the week, the lettuce is grown by the FFA kids for Southeast Polk High School. And when you talk to him, he's like, this is the future of agriculture. He's like, everyone thinks about farming as corn and beans and, you know, cows and all this stuff. And that is part of the future of agriculture. But you can imagine that, let's say you have
but it's not the only future right, of agriculture.
Like, I guess my dream, as I'm starting to talk, and I'm starting to think that this is where we're going to head maybe with the next film, is sort of into agricultural innovations. But you could imagine an Iowa in the future where, you know, instead of having these 10,000-acre farms that are just corn and beans, you know, these older landowners could see that, you know, it's not just about the dollars, and they could give opportunities to young people to start these types of diversified farms within, you know, you don't need much of a footprint for these aquaponics systems. A kid could have a really productive.
It's like greenhouse size.
Yeah, you could have just give a kid like a couple of acres and that would be more than enough to have a really cool locally sourced, they could be selling locally sourced lettuce and fish, you know, to the Iowa community.
So the parents could continue farming their 5,000 yep. acres of corn and beans if they just carved off 5 acres for each right. child.
So it's like, is it worth having 5,000 or 4,998?
You know, I mean, keeping your kids
and
around.
Keeping your kids around.
Considering the price of corn per acre or soybeans per acre.
The kids might do better.
right. Also last night.
I think
night,
they would.
Yes. Also, it mentioned last night, you don't always have to be a child of a farmer. There are many, many people that are interested in getting involved in this growing experience.
Because it's meaningful work.
Yeah, it's meaningful work. And getting a relationship with the kid down the road, if you're a farmer, maybe he or she, and I like hearing that a lot more. He or she would like to farm 5 acres on a corner of your place.
And I think it's absolutely incumbent upon older people that own land in America. You know, at the end of the day, you need to ask yourself the question, do you want to make a couple extra dollars that you're going to pay half of to Uncle Sam? Or what is your legacy going to be for the next generation? And I think America's landowners have some really big questions to ask themselves in the next 10 to 15 years, because we're slated to have half of America's farmland change hands in the next 12 years.
That's a big deal. That's never happened.
It's only happened in wartime in the world's history. This is the first time that it's going to happen in a peaceful transition, hopefully. So basically, I think our older landowners hold the key to America's next agriculture. And if they decide to try to cash out every penny, they're going to destroy agriculture in America. If they decide to give young people an opportunity to get started, a chance, then they're going to create something beautiful that will be a wonderful legacy for the next generation.
It's nice to hear you. And actually, there's more people talking about this now. Creating something meaningful, something beautiful, something that, well,
something so functional.
It's not necessarily bottom line. I think maybe we add up our bottom lines with the wrong things up
right,
front.
Right. It's not all dollars and cents.
There was a lot of talk about community last night, even among the more traditional farmers at the talk afterwards. Oh, well, our towns are getting smaller, and people are moving away.
And the schools have to
consolidate.
Schools are consolidating. You covered that. Now, your film breaks it down into five things. What are with the little graphics, what were those five? You kind of laid it all out pretty carefully. I like that. Can you?
Sure. Yeah, we start off talking about how technology has gotten bigger and bigger, which has allowed farmers to get bigger and bigger. And
that's where he showed the 12-row combine.
Exactly, yeah. And we have a lot less people in rural America now, so you have these massive consolidations. That's the first section of the film, which is called Fewer Farmers. The second section is all about this sort of naive, idealistic, first-generation farmers that are coming up in urban America. And so that's, we call that newbies. So they've got a lot of backbone, they got a lot of heart, but they also don't have a lot of experience.
And they don't have any land.
They don't have land, but they're coming up with cool ways to get around that. And then our third section is bridge builders. So those are the kids of commodity farmers who see the potential in local agriculture and are really embracing that and starting viable, thriving business models from that. And then we sort of come back to, well, but most of the kids in rural America actually don't have land. And so how do you deal with getting around some of those issues? So the fourth section is about land. And then the final section, we say that ultimately we're all in this together, and we have we tell some stories about FFA, about the Farmer Veteran Coalition, and also about a cooperative economic model at Organic Valley where you have farmers being able to – farmers own Organic Valley. And so it is a co-op. So 2,000 farmers own it. It's a $1 billion company. And when they have a problem, the farmers weigh in. Whereas when there's a problem at Pilgrim's Pride, the stockholders weigh in and the farmers they get cut immediately. So they cut them out right away. The contract's dead. But when farmers are ones calling the shots, guess what? Farmers don't get tossed aside.
Actually, that was a good Organic Valley story that you told. Tell me if I'm recapping this properly, but there was a moment when there was a glut of milk and prices were dropping. And if I'm not correct, I think we were having a glut of organic milk right now as well. So the farmers got together, and rather than cut out the most recent members, every farmer decided to kind of take a quota and downgrade their own income ability a little bit just to keep these other farmers going. That is the value of a co-op. You can do that.
Exactly. It's this sense that we're all in this together, and I think fundamentally our entire culture and our entire economy is built on a win-lose model. So it's very competitive. The idea is that if we extract as much as we can from the land and then we extract as much as we can from the people that we hire.
Yeah, and everything else be damned,
and then it gets
right?
extracted at each level more and more. And so farmers at the bottom level – so they're getting extracted the most, which is why you've seen us go from 6 million farmers in 1980 to 3 million farmers today. Because when you have an exploitative capitalistic model, basically the people at the bottom are going to get hurt the most and the people at the top are going to get helped the most. And so I think one of the things we need to look at as we sort of move forward in America with our next agriculture is, you know, how are these systems that we currently have in place serving us? Like, are they healthy for us? Are they healthy for the land? Are they healthy for the farmers? And we need to look at a way in which we can set up economic models that benefit farmers and that benefit the land. And that's not going to be easy. There's certainly no easy answers. But I think we can definitively say that right now we're taking and taking and taking from the land, and we're taking and we're taking and we're taking from farmers. And if you destroy the land and you destroy the people who care for the land, then
what are we going to eat?
Exactly.
I think this is true of all of the business systems in America, but it's particularly clear when you focus it on farms. Now, an interesting thing happened last night after you showed the film that's very indicative of this. So half the audience are these farmers who probably in the next two or three years will be probably farming with their families, you know, the young men with the hats and the all, you know, the hall was full of them. It was a nice crowd. They're all drawn from various ISU agronomy programs. And so this is on the college level. So after the film, one young man says to Graham, do you think this organic thing is actually viable, or is it just a passing Tell us about your response to that.
Well, I think the organic local food movement is here to stay. There are a lot of people who have decided to shape their lives around their food choices. I'm one of those people. It's very important to me that my food dollar goes directly to farmers. And so when my family buys beef or pork or tomatoes or carrots.
And this is in New York City.
This is in New York City. Mm-hmm. I travel a lot, though, too. So I definitely add a lot of co-ops. And, whenever I can, I want the farmer to get as much of the food dollar as possible. Mm-hmm. Because, like I was saying earlier, if you go to Walmart and you buy a bag of hot and spicy chicken wings, the chicken farmer that raised those chickens is going to get 5 cents on the dollar. So,
and he's lucky if he gets that.
Right. And so 5 cents on the dollar and 95 cents, where does that 95 cents go? It goes to the distributor. But largely it goes to the shareholders of whatever company that's a system that's fundamentally broken. Because when you have people that are on Wall Street investing in stocks that are making more money off of a bag of chicken wings than the person who actually produced the chickens, then something's fundamentally broken. And so we actually every day, every one of you listening and everyone in America has an opportunity to spend their money on something that will create our next agriculture. And so I don't take that responsibility lightly, and I don't think you should either. And I would suggest that if you have an opportunity, seek out a place where you can buy food directly from farmers. Go to a farmer's website, buy directly from a farmer. Go to a co-op, go to a restaurant that sources locally, and make sure that your food dollar is going directly to those farmers. And there's a lot of economic sense behind it as well. John Maynard Keynes in the 1930s discovered the principle known as the local multiplier effect. And basically what it says is that when you keep money in a local economy, that money gets circled back within your community three times more than if you spend it with some large multinational.
Creating jobs rather than sending the money. Like when you shop at Walmart, the money goes to Arkansas, that sort of thing. Now, so the young man that asked you about organic last night, and this is what I liked about the film, it really lays out options for beginning farmers. And, of course, my question is, how could he go through, 4 years of ag studies and not know anything about organic? But
really, truly, I talked to the young man last night, and he really, truly said, "You're the first organic farmer I've ever met." And here we are in
right.
the middle of Ames. And I said, "Well, I'm glad to meet you." And that's what is so nice about a film like this. Thank you, Graham, for doing this, because the discussions that happen afterwards, we need to talk to one another. We are neighbors here. We have different ways of doing things. There are a lot of options.
There was another person, I think, in the question and answer. Correct me if I didn't hear this properly, but she was saying, and I think it was a woman, that with organic crops, there is a premium, and prices are very, very low on corn and soy right now. So the premium is attractive, and it is – she basically said, if you're willing to farm organically, you can afford to farm. And I'm sure that's why that young man asked that question. He was going, well, if I can make more money doing it this way, or at least make enough money to stay in business getting the organic premium, but is organic reliable? Well, yes, it's a good solid percent of the American food system at this point. It is an industry that has been growing every year for the last 30 years. This is, as Graham says, is not going away. And it is an opportunity for younger farmers. And I'm glad, Graham, that your film presents these options, because there was a CAFO discussion last night, for example. And a lot of the young farmers have been told that the only way they can go home and farm with their families is to put a CAFO operation on, that's the only thing that will generate enough without an expanding land base. Well, clearly that's not true. It is an option, but it is not the only option. So there was that CAFOs are very contentious in our communities, because people feel they, you know, the farming families feel they need to do that so they can keep their kids on the farm. But the people living around the CAFOs don't want them because it's land values drop, water pollution, air pollution. You know, so it's a bit sad that these really well-trained agronomy students are not given other options.
Well, the reality is that if you want to start get a hog barn or a CAFO, basically the government and the bank is going to support you the whole way through. And I've talked to
it's a proven business model for them.
Yep. And I've talked to a lot of farmers that, you know, they never have those contracts get pulled. So if you're able to get started on a hog barn or a CAFO or whatever you want to call it, then you have a 100% chance, assuming that you live during that time period of 10 or 12 years, that you will have a significant return on investment. So basically, you know, when change has to happen, it has to happen at every level. It has to happen from the top down, from the bottom up, from the middle out. And so we're in a situation where we are currently, as a government, as a people, as a culture, we are rewarding this system of agriculture. People who are cashing in their, you know, to keep their family farms going, doing what is rewarded.
You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa.
So if we want to create our next agriculture in a way that's healthy for farmers, that's healthy for people, that's healthy for economies, we need to stop supporting a system.
The subsidies.
Subsidies. So I think – and I've talked to so many farmers where I was shocked. They're corn and bean farmers, and they're telling me that it would actually be totally fine with them if subsidies were – if we got weaned off of subsidies. So I think one of the big steps is weaning America off of corn and soybean subsidies. That's not going to be simple. It's a very complex issue. But I think if we had maybe a long window, like a 10-year period or a 15-year period, it could be done in a responsible way. And then, you know, we might even want to look into policies that are really supportive for young people to get into farming. So maybe that's
– one would hope.
Healthcare for farmers, you know, that would be obviously universal healthcare. That could be a hot button issue. I personally believe that every American should have healthcare, and that would help out so many farmers.
It's because not impossible.
It helps so many farmers because so many farmers I've talked to, they had to go get a town job And once you get the town job, then, you know, your energies get pulled, you get sapped, and it kind of kills the farm situation. And so if we had universal health care, these young people could start farming without this fear of losing their farm and losing their livelihoods if something happened. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of potential for positive change. And really, there's this unique moment where we're going to have this huge shift in land. We're going to have a huge generational shift. And so I think that means there's a real opportunity to change things. And these next 10 to 15 years are going to be really important that we have constructive conversations. Because the second you tell someone that, you know, you're a bad person, your CAFO is bad, the first thing they're going to do is stop listening to you. And the second thing they're going to do is try to do anything opposite of what you want them to do. And I'm not saying that CAFOs are bad. There's a lot of efficiencies there. There's a lot of positive things to putting animals in a barn, but maybe we can work together and figure out something where,
improve,
you know,
the system,
yeah, the
a bit. Right.
Yeah, the pigs have access to the outdoors. The
effluent is treated differently.
Exactly. And the farmers, the air quality can get – let's talk about the farmer's health more than the pig's health too. That's really important to me. Like, you know, everyone talks about, oh, the poor animals. And I agree that animals are important. But let's talk about the farmer's health. Like, if their asthma rates are going up when they're in these places that have so much fecal particulate in the air, they know that. They're thinking about that. So let's try to create a system that's healthy for the farmer, that's healthy for the neighbor, that's healthy for the eater. And we can do that if we start by saying, hey, thanks. Thanks for farming. We start a conversation in a way that's going to be productive and healing and appreciative of one another. Then that's where you start to work together.
Well, Graham Merriweather, I want to thank you for making that film at the showing. Not only did the film demonstrate that, but the convergence of farmers at the table, basically, also built some bridges.
Yes, it did. So what's in the future for you and your film and showing it to a lot of people?
Well, we're doing screenings across America. We've had over 800 people across the country request a screening. So we have screenings every day. If you go to our website.
800 different groups?
800 different people have said that they wanted to host a screening.
In their community.
Yeah, in their community.
Wow.
So we're doing a totally different distribution model. Like I said, the typical movie distribution model is you apply to a film festival, then you get rejected. Then you apply to another film festival, then you get rejected. Then you might get in, and then you pray that there's some sort of magical distribution deal that comes through. And then, you know, then it's in the theaters for a weekend, and then maybe you'll do some ancillary, like, grassroots thing, and then it goes to digital. And so we have totally turned it on its head. We don't apply to any film festivals. We bring the film directly to the communities that are relevant for the film. And then, you know, we sort of grow out from there. And so with this film, we decided, we said, let's do our trailer, let our trailer go, and just tell people if they want to, they're the ones that can premiere the film in their hometown if they want to bring it. We've had over 400,000 people see the trailer since we released it. And like I said, 800 people across the country have decided to host a screening in their church, in their community center, in their school, in their independent movie house, in their restaurant.
So then they can just buy a copy or download a copy?
So we sell community screening licenses. We also are doing something that's never been tried before by any movie, which is I'm calling it a revenue sharing system. And basically, so if
their organization wants to use it for a funder.
Right. So like we have organizations that will, like, let's say you have a contact with a movie theater or something like that. Ideally, we want to get the venue for free, and then we just split it 50-50.
Better than a bake sale.
Right. So it's like, you know, we'll generate – it's basically putting the ownership of the distribution on the people that are interested in the film. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we get some percentage of that because we made the film. So it feels fair, and it's been a really interesting model that – you know, because again, I think it's funny how when something happens, like our food, I think everyone is noticing that like every system is broken right now. You know, like we have our media is broken, our television is broken, our food is broken, our
radio is broken,
newspapers are broken. you know, basically, and I was just talking mainly, but it's every industry that's kind of doesn't really know what to do right now, and I feel like this sense that something major is happening in agriculture is happening across our culture. And so this is a really important moment where we're going to sort of, like I was getting to earlier, redefine the way that that money changes hands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, instead of having an exploitative model for the farmer or the filmmaker or the whoever, you know, we set up models in which people sort of work together and we're able to have a more equitable system.
This could be a really powerful thing, this direct marketing of good ideas. My goodness, it sounds like a very good thing to do. It sounds like planting a garden.
Well, yes, and it's a fun film. We really enjoyed it. It's quite beautiful, of course, and has a lot to say.
Yes. The film is Farmers for America by Graham Merriweather.
Oh, you must have a website. What is it, Graham, where they can see the trailer?
FarmersForAmericaFilm.com, or you could go to LeaveItBetter.com. That's the name of our production company, Leave It Better. We really would love to come back to Iowa and do some screenings for FFA chapters in the fall. So if there's anyone out there that's interested in potentially partnering with us on that, feel free to reach out to us through our website as well.
Bravo. Thank you, Graham Merriweather.
Thank you, Lana and Donna.
You're listening to KHOI, community radio for the heart of Iowa, and you are also listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. If you'd like to find out more about this fine radio station and about this fine show, go to KHOIFM.org. On that site, you can find out about a lot of other good local programming that happens right here at this radio station. This radio station is on 24/7. You'd be surprised what you can find here. Donna, tell me about Beats.
Well, this was the 20th year of this event that I do always in Anaheim at the Natural Products Trade Show, and it's a fundraiser for a group called Organic Farming Research Foundation. I did this recipe that I really enjoyed doing. It's from a book called The New Midwestern Table by Amy Thielen, which is about the best and only really, truly Midwestern cookbook. I really like it. And it's a beet dish. So, you know, we did it for 300. So I feel pretty comfortable with the recipe by now. And it's really basic. I often just boil my beets because it's so easy and the skins slip right off. And these are just, you know, your standard red beets. But she called to have them roasted over a fire. Well, we didn't do that, but we did want to roast them in the oven. So Chris, my co-chef, who's a very experienced restaurant chef, taught me this technique, which I will use again, because often when you roast them in the oven, it is a little harder to slip the skins off. And as a home cook, you know, I don't have 20 choppers and peelers in the kitchen to deal with that. So what Chris showed me to do is you know, just scrub them up, leave the skins on, and you leave the root and the top on. You don't trim that off. And then you put it in a pan and you put a little bit of water in the bottom, like a half an inch. And then you cover with aluminum foil, which ends up being you're still roasting them. So you get that concentrated flavor, which is why you want to roast them. It does make them sweeter and a little more flavorful. But the little bit of water in the pan does loosen the skins. So this is a technique I'm going to use for cooking beets from now on. I really, really liked it. So the recipe in the book, which is at this point is kind of scaled to a normal household, she calls it campfire baked beets with hazelnut sesame salt. Now, the part that I really liked was the hazelnut sesame salt. So basically, she's using about 2 pounds or 5 medium beets. So you roast those up. Now, I, of course, changed the recipe a little bit. I also used a large dice of red onions. So I put onions and beets in the mixture, and I just lightly sautéed those onions till they were not dead, but the heat was gone out of them. So you roast the beets and cut them into kind of bite-sized pieces, and then I did the same with the onions and mixed them together, and then you just put a vinegar and oil, salt and pepper. And she recommended a red wine vinegar, which I used, and it was very good. So you've got your basic beet salad there. Then, this is the fun part, and I will do this again, and I will probably use it on other things. You take your hazelnuts, and you roast them. And then, you know, hazelnuts have a skin on them. So you have to take, like, a towel or something and just roll them till most of the skin comes off. It's a little annoying, but it's not that big a deal. For her recipe, she used Oh, only a third cup of hazelnuts toasted. I think I was a little, I got into the hazelnuts, let's say. Okay, so then you roast the hazelnuts, rub the skins off, and they are just delicious. And then she says you pound them too, and she used the word rubble. And I like that because that really describes, you don't want a fine paste, but you don't want a half a nut. You want it really crumbly. And that just kind of busts the flavor out of these fresh roasted.
Now this is pounding, not Cuisinarting them. You don't want butter.
No, I think at home I would probably, one of my favorite tricks is I put them in a fairly thick plastic bag and just bang it with something, you know, till you get that. And you spread them out so they're kind of a thin layer, and you just keep popping them till you know, because you can go too far and then you do have just mush. Then you put in third of a cup of hazelnuts with a tablespoon and a half of sesame seeds. So I just took some sesame seeds. I used the white ones. And then I also pounded the same way. It doesn't hurt if you don't want them to turn to tahini, but you know, they're pretty small anyway. So I think I did those in my food mill coffee grinder kind of thing. And then into that, this is the fun part. You take a small clove of garlic and you pound it small enough, really, really fine, so that it mixes in. So you've got raw garlic, hazelnuts, sesame seeds, and then a pinch of sugar and salt and pepper. And this makes this beautiful, it was so delicious. And I think if you make extra and put it in the refrigerator, it would be good on like a sauteed chicken dish, or it was just, steam some green beans. There are all kinds of uses for that. So it's just salt, pepper, and a little bit of sugar with the sesame seeds, the hazelnut, and then in the end, I did chop chives into the vinegared beets and onions. So you have a little bit of green in there, and then you just kind of spread the hazelnuts over the top of the salad. Oh, yum. It was really, really good.
Now, doesn't that sound good? I think this sort of recipe may just end up on the Donalana Kitchen recipe page whenever we can get around to it.
It was delightful. Yeah. I was quite taken with it.
That's the idea of adding a little bit of sugar too.
Yeah, not enough that they taste sweet, but it was with the garlic and the salt and pepper and the nuts and the seeds. It was just really, really yummy.
Great, great. Okay. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We come to you every week at KHOI FM here at Community Radio Station. You can hear us live at noon every Tuesday and repeated 7 o'clock in the evening. Today we had Graham Meriwether join us talking about his film, a filmmaker, someone that tells stories with film. Join us every week for this fine program. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.